Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
This is Premium Episode 43, The Cathars Part 1, Not All Gnostics, or The Albigensian Crusade. Today I'm recording from the Languedoc in France. For those of you who have not heard my episodes with Monty about the Knights Templar, you should go check that out. First of all, they're great episodes, but we talk briefly about this in those episodes, and in some ways those episodes are a good primer for this one. Now, Catharism has been called the most successful heresy of the Middle Ages. It extended loosely throughout Europe, but it was especially prevalent in what's now known as southern France. Other hotspots were Germany, Italy, and Bulgaria. The Cathars believed the world was evil, and the way to deal with that fact was through fasting and principled pacifism. They rejected the Catholic Church as satanic. The Cathars believed in worshiping outside instead of inside extravagant cathedrals. They believed in dressing simply rather than spending money on priestly clothing. The Cathars had women in positions of leadership within their organizations. Catharism was incredibly popular among the peasants and the early trades, and among the early skilled workers. In response to the Cathars, the Catholic Church launched the Albigensian Crusade to exterminate the threat. To extinguish the Cathars completely, they then launched the Inquisition. The Albigensian Crusade, while still in line with the previous crusades in the Middle East, was notable for being the first European genocide, depending on how you reckon genocides, right? Pope Innocent III's legate famously gave the command, "Kill them all, God will recognize his own," which would be quoted forever afterwards, right? Separate from the context, it is a pretty memorable and badass quote. Estimates for how many people died in the Albigensian Crusade range from 200,000 to 1 million Cathars killed. Well, we'll get to that, but they were not all Cathars. And this was largely not combat, right? So in many ways, the fate of the Cathars is the fate of Western Europe. And what occurred there has occurred again and again and again. That said, there are many facts and lessons that we can learn from the Cathars that are still surprisingly relevant to today. Additionally, the Cathars, like the Knights Templar, are subject to a lot of cultic milieu bullshit and crazy historical revisionism and just, you know, straight making things up, right? So keep that in mind, and I'm going to attempt to be as rigorous as possible. Which is not too difficult when we're talking about, we'll explain where it gets hairy, but the first part of this episode is not going to be too bad. And then we will get into the weird stuff after that. But what does Cathar mean? It's believed that Cathar comes from the Greek word katharos, or clean and pure. So to be a Cathar would be to be a clean one, or a pure one. And where did the Cathars come from? Some historians argue that they have roots in the Essenes, a collection of radical Jewish groups associated with the Dead Sea, the Qumran Caves, all the Dead Sea Scrolls, Gnostic groups, which, you know, existed around the 2nd century BC to the 1st century AD. My understanding is that this is possible, but it's not clear that that's the case. What is known for a fact is that the Cathars held many of the same beliefs as the Essenes, which is to say they took vows, many of them were celibate, they prayed and fasted, they held many of the same beliefs. We'll elaborate on their beliefs in a second here. The main known predecessor and group that existed somewhat concurrently was the main group to the Cathars was the Bogomils, who were a let me say that whole thing again. The main known predecessor, and for a time they were going concurrently, was the group known as the Bogomils. They were a religious group in the First Bulgarian Empire around the 10th century. So considerably after the Essenes, right? There are probably a lot of groups in between that point, but the historical records are lacking. It's not clear what Bogomil even means, because some people say it means friends of God or something along those lines. Some people say Bogomil was a priest who taught these ideas. But what is known is that they rejected church structures and hierarchies. The theory is that either Bulgarian repression of the Bogomils drove some of them into Western Europe, or that their teachings spread through port towns, or that the Crusaders were exposed to Bogomil ideas and brought them back to southern France and Italy and so forth. Realistically, it's probably some mixture of all three, right? Now, without doing a whole thing on dualism and Zoroastrianism and the mystery religions and Marcionism, Arianism, and Manichaeism, it's important to understand that there is a long philosophical and religious tradition that views the world as dualistic, that the world is divided into good and evil, and that this world represents a battle between those two forces. Again, without going through the whole history of Gnostic thought, this dualistic worldview is very related to Gnosticism. Catharism, by all accounts, seems to have roots in several of these previous heresies, like Docetism, which was the idea that Jesus Christ appeared not in the flesh but as an apparition, like a ghost or something along those lines. A major difference between the Cathars and these previous Gnostics was that the Cathars still believed that salvation was made available through priestly ministrations of their clergy, rather than through direct gnosis. In that regard, the Cathars were closer to the Catholic Church than some of these Gnostic groups. Manichaeanism, which is its own thing, right? But a short version of its history would be that there was a Persian prophet named Mani. The idea, or the understanding of Manichaeanism, is that it's a fusion of several religious influences, especially Zoroastrianism. But the idea is to unite humanity into two groups, the elect and the listeners. The elect being a priesthood class, practicing asceticism, celibacy, you know, refraining from eating meat or consuming wine, focusing on teaching and doing good deeds, while the listeners were to follow certain rules, but could still marry, eat meat, you know, generally live as normal people. Manichaeanism was persecuted and banned by the Roman Empire, but the name Manichaeanism continued as a byword for heretic or dualist, or even just someone you disagreed with. Some people believe that the word mania and maniac derive from Manichaeanism. That is to say, after the Latin root, right? That is to say, the Latin words derive from that. Now, I will quote from an academic dissertation here on the Cathar's doctrine. According to Cathar doctrine, after the fall, Satan imprisoned the souls of the fallen angels in the prison of the flesh, which he had created, together with the material world. Through the process of reproduction, the soul was continually reincarnated, but moving from one prison to another, in a human or animal form. Christ came as an angel to redeem the souls, but he did not appear in the flesh, nor did he suffer. Unquote. Cathars rejected the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, but they accepted other parts of the Old Testament, which is interesting. The Cathars believed in reading the Bible in the vernacular, which is to say, in the language people actually spoke, rather than Greek or Latin, or which is to say, like, the average person, right? The Cathars were frequently vegetarian and or pescatarian. They believed that fish were not meat, which was not a belief unique to them. That was sort of a Middle Ages thing. no one could see when fish were fucking, basically. So there was this idea that fish generated spontaneously. Which I don't really understand, because, like, didn't they eat caviar? But, okay, whatever. So, the Cathars practiced fasting, and relevant to this story, the Cathars believed it was wrong to lie under any circumstances. Now, I will quote from that academic work here again. The Christians, for such is the name that the Cathars gave themselves, were divided into two classes, the Perfecti and the Believers. The Perfecti, including men and women, were the teachers who had received the gift of the Consolamentum, which is to say, the visitation of the Spirit, and who lived lives of extreme austerity and holiness. They promised to abjure the Roman Catholic Church and all doctrines connected to it. They led lives of rigid chastity and never had sexual contact with a member of the opposite sex, even if they were married. Unquote. So you see, the Cathars had historical ties to and similar doctrines with various previous groups of Gnostics, Neo-Gnostics, and heretical groups in the past. The first heretics started to appear in southern France around the turn of the millennium. Mind you, this is heretics that we know of, not Cathars yet. Pope Sylvester II, the Frenchman who reigned as Pope from the year 999, to the year 1003, he made an interesting disposition in the year 991. This was when he was not Pope yet, but consecrated Archbishop. While he was Archbishop and he made this disposition, he reiterated his belief in the Old and New Testament, in marriage, in eating meat, and the existence of the devil. You know, normal things for Catholic archbishops to believe in. It's so weird, but the context is that it's believed that he was responding to accusations of believing in Bogomil-style proto-Cathar beliefs in the area. Or, like, either arguing against them or, you know, asserting that he no longer held those beliefs and making a show about his orthodoxy. Which is pretty funny. Like, becoming archbishop and being like, by the way, I do, in fact, believe in Jesus. Like, was anyone saying you didn't? So in the year 1018, the citizens of Orleans, I'm going to say it like an Anglo, I'm sorry, Orléans, I don't know. The citizens were accused of being Manichaeans, of rejecting the cross and baptism. The Catholic Church accused them of worshiping the devil in the form of an Ethiopian. The church accused them of various other heresies, also of carrying out orgies, conducting child sacrifices, and performing magical flights. These would all pop up again in the witch hunts of the late Middle Ages and Renaissance period, but this was a relatively new thing. This wasn't very common, right? And what happened to the Orleans group? They were all burned at the stake. By the way, I have less than no way of evaluating whether they were actually doing those things, but through what little I know of the Cathars, it is unlikely that they were guilty of these crimes, right? Now, Pope Gregory VII instituted widespread reforms in the Catholic Church, which aimed to do several things all at once. On the one hand, these reforms were meant to clean up the Church, thereby undercutting legitimate critiques of the Church by heretical groups. On the other hand, the reforms reiterated that the Catholic Church was the only means by which one could be saved. Interesting side note. one of Pope Gregory VII's reformers named Humbert of Moyenmoutier, who was a cardinal. He actually excommunicated the Patriarch of Constantinople, which was the key event which caused the Great Schism between the Catholic and Orthodox churches. When papal reform goes wrong, right? Now, the first known instance of Cathars is in 1143, when a monk named Eberwin wrote to Bernard of Clairvaux about the discovery of two different heretical groups in the city of Cologne. Yes, Cologne in future Germany. These two groups were identified because they were arguing with each other over religious doctrine. These heretics were brought before the bishop of Cologne, and the bishop found out that this was not some light heresy or basic anti-clericalism, which they were used to. They found out that these heretics were part of an entire underground church that put itself in direct opposition to Rome. Now, from this point on, it's important to note the fact that the overwhelming amount of evidence and information we have about the Cathars was written by their enemies, the Catholic Church. So keep that in mind. We know that as recently as the Illuminati, you can't exactly trust them to be honest about their enemies, right? So keep that in mind. So Bernard of Clairvaux, who was an extremely important figure in the Catholic Church back then, he accused the Cathars of all kinds of crimes. But he insisted that the Cathars needed to be preached to with persuasion, not with force. But he also noted, he would write this, "It would without a doubt be better that they should be coerced by the sword of him who beareth not the sword in vain, than that they should be allowed to draw away many other persons into their error." So pretty much allowing for the use of force if necessary. Now, it's important to note that there were two major Cistercian preaching missions to the Languedoc in the years 1145 and 1178, Cistercian being an order like Franciscan or Dominican, right? And these two preaching missions were exactly that, trying to preach, debate, persuade, you know, rather than use force. We will talk about these missions at great length here in a minute. So in 1145, Hildegard of Bingen, an abbess and major intellectual, another key figure in the church, she had an apocalyptic vision, which she understood to mean that the Cathars themselves, like the existence of Cathars, was a sign that the devil had been released from the bottomless pit, which would inevitably lead to the destruction of all mankind. In 1163, an abbot named Ecbert wrote 13 sermons which refuted Cathar doctrines point by point. Because the sermons were a systematic refutation of their beliefs, it is believed that this is like relatively accurate, a minimum degree of lying, right? And probably not a ton of misrepresenting their beliefs, like less than maybe other statements. At worst, it's probably uncharitably misrepresenting some positions, right? So this is a useful text. So Ecbert wrote that the Cathars hate the flesh and avoided contact with it, which appears to be true, both in procreative and dietary terms. Ecbert wrote that the Cathars were known by various names other than Cathar. For instance, in Flanders they called them Piflis, and in France they called them Texerant. Nobody really knows what Piflis is supposed to refer to, but Texerant probably refers to weaving. We will return to the topic of weaving in a little bit. Now, separate from what Ecbert wrote, the Cathars were frequently accused of stealing children and sacrificing them. Curiously, these accusations against the Cathars very closely mirrored the later accusations that would be leveled at Jews, which in my mind suggests that there was probably not a lot of truth to these accusations. Additionally, there was never really much evidence for child stealing, period. And trust me, I was looking. I actually went into the Cathar story with an open mind to the Cathars being sus and or guilty of doing witchcraft. I did not find a lot of evidence that that's the case, and I read so much more on the Cathars than you would think. Like, I did a stupid amount of research for this, actually. One book that I read on the Cathars stated that the Cathars were, quote, often regarded as being better Christians than their Catholic counterparts, a fact which the Catholic Church was later forced to acknowledge, unquote. Now, the main sacrament that the Cathars practiced was called the Consolamentum, which was supposed to be an equivalent to baptism, sort of, but more like the receiving of the Holy Spirit part of it. And when administered on someone's deathbed, would also function as a sort of extreme unction. The Cathars only had one prayer, or one like formal prayer, which was the Lord's Prayer. And they viewed the God of the Old Testament as satanic. Like I mentioned before, they rejected church buildings altogether, and instead they met in members' homes, they met in barns, they met in fields. They rejected the cross, as they viewed it as a symbol of Christ's torture. They had three classes in their sect: listeners, believers, and perfect, or perfecti. Why, yes, this does make me think of the perfectibilists. Maybe more on that in a little bit. So the group, the listeners, were those who would not or could not commit to the faith, but who, as you might guess, listened to the sermons. Believers participated in a formal ceremony and made up the majority of the membership. They did not abstain or follow as many rules as the perfect did. The perfect were essentially the Cathar priesthood, and you became a perfect through the aforementioned consolamentum rite. The Cathars viewed the sexes as equal, and women were allowed to become perfects. To quote Sean Martin's book on the Cathars, which is one of my main sources, he said, "In short, if you're a woman in the Languedoc of the year 1200, it made more sense to be a Cathar than a Catholic," unquote. In England, there was a group which may have been Cathar or Cathar adjacent, and that group was active in Canterbury and Oxford. They were identified and punished through the horrific practice. I'm not sure if there's a name for this practice, but basically they stripped these believers of their clothing and in wintertime, and kicked them out into the cold, thereby condemning them all to die of exposure. And of course, no one was allowed to give them clothes or, you know, shelter. So, on to the Albigensian Crusade. The Languedoc is the historical region of southern France, which mostly corresponds to modern-day Occitania, which is to say not the entirety of the French Mediterranean coast, but a large chunk in the middle of it. We're mainly talking about Toulouse. Again, I'm saying this like an Anglo. Toulouse, which was the main city, along with Montpellier, Nîmes, Béziers, and Alais. The main guy, so to speak, the main guy was the Count of Toulouse, Raymond VI, whose court was an interesting mixture of Catholics, Cathars, even Jews, which was atypical at the time. Or, you know, notable for there being Jews there. The Catholic Church in the Languedoc was deeply unpopular, and there was said to have been churches where no mass had been given for many years. The locals even had a phrase, "I'd rather be a priest," which was a phrase they said whenever they, you know, said, whenever they were asked to do something they didn't want to do. They'd say, "I'd rather be a priest." The Bishop of Toulouse actually bankrupted his diocese by hiring mercenaries to go after his own vassals. It was just a very corrupt diocese, right? So in 1187, the Crusaders lost Jerusalem. This had widespread repercussions. There were reverberations throughout Christendom. In 1198, Pope Innocent III sent a major missionary effort to the Languedoc to resolve this whole Cathar thing. Pope Innocent III would issue a papal bull, Virgentis Insignium, which equated heresy with the Roman crime of treason against the emperor, and the punishment for heresy was now to be the confiscation of property and disinheritance for your family, as well as forfeiture of the right to hold civil office, to practice law, or to practice as clergy. Ratcheting up the repercussions for being a Cathar, in other words. Pope Innocent III dispatched Arnold Amory, Peter of Castelnau, and the hilariously named Brother Ralph to go crack down on the heretics. The dream team, in other words, these three guys. It's hard for me not to imagine just Ralph from The Simpsons, but the first strategy of these three was to force the nobility to swear oaths of allegiance to the Catholic Church, then to get them to agree to pass anti-Cathar legislation. Then they planned on debating with the Cathars in public. And they did this. They held a public debate at Carcassonne in 1204. Scholars have called this debate inconclusive. Now, the Cathars obviously hated the Cistercian missionaries. I should have mentioned the three guys, the dream team, the three amigos. They were all Cistercian monks, right? But it wasn't just the Cathars who hated these guys. The local clergy hated them. You know, a classic situation where it's like, corporate's coming down. They're going to fuck everything up. The nobility also hated having these guys around. They particularly hated being strong-armed into signing loyalty oaths. Like, nobody liked these guys. So around springtime, one of the missionaries, Peter of Castelnau, he wanted Raymond VI to persecute his Cathar population. Raymond VI refused to do what he was asking, probably more due to him trying to maintain control of his own population, probably less due to any, you know, proto-liberal sentiments or religious beliefs. He had Cathar sympathies in the sense that he had subjects who were Cathars. It's not likely that he actually cared about it. So his reluctance to persecute the Cathars caused Peter of Castelnau to excommunicate Raymond VI on the spot, which was, I have to mention, already the second time Raymond VI would be excommunicated. Amazingly, it would not be the last time. Still, by the summertime, Raymond VI agreed to start persecuting the Cathars and carrying out this legislation, and his excommunication was lifted. But by autumn, he hadn't done anything, so he was excommunicated a third time. By 1208, the missionaries, the Catholic Cistercian missionaries, met at Raymond VI's castle. Reportedly, the meeting went poorly, with threats and shouting on both sides. Peter of Castelnau left for Rome, but he was struck down by a hooded rider who drove a sword into him. Now, to this day, nobody knows who the assassin was or why Peter of Castelnau was killed. But this assassination provoked the Albigensian Crusade. as the story goes, when Pope Innocent III heard the news of this assassination, he was said to have buried his face in his hands and went off to pray at St. Peter's Basilica, right? Now, in the Middle Ages, warfare was a seasonal thing, so war didn't come until the next year, but an army of nobility, knights, and mercenaries assembled to attack the Languedoc. Pope Innocent III gave them the standard crusader indulgence, which consisted of forgiveness for all sins, cancellation of debts, and the promise of plunder from the Cathars. Like the standard feudal armies of the time, enlisted men signed up for 40-day contracts before they would be released from their obligations and allowed to return home. If you'll recall, the Crusaders had already lost Jerusalem, so many of the Crusaders would participate in the Albigensian Crusade. Interestingly, I've heard that the Knights Templar were not at all into this, although almost certainly individual Templars would participate. Simon de Montfort was chosen to lead this army. So Raymond VI chose, instead of resisting, he chose to undergo scourging, like literal scourging, and submission to the Catholic Church. Real, like, sackcloth and ashes type shit. This was probably a wise move in terms of realpolitik. So on July 21st, 1209, we have pretty accurate information for the actual crusade. An army of roughly 10,000 attacked the city of Béziers and massacred literally everyone there. Estimates from the papal legate put the number of citizens killed at 20,000. The massacre at Béziers was one of the most notable events, but the ensuing bloodbath was all pretty harrowing. There's the story of the small town of Braum that went through a 3-day siege before the Crusaders captured everyone and then mutilated every man in the town. What they did was they cut off their upper lips and blinded every man except for a single man who was left with one eye, who then guided all of the other blind men to the nearest town, 20 miles away, as a warning, because that town had not yet been captured. Which would be so fucked up, right? So on July 22nd, 1210, the Crusaders burned 140 Cathars at the stake in the town of Minerve. The Crusaders captured a series of fortified towns after that. In what passes for a war crime, even in the Middle Ages, the Crusaders hanged all of the knights who had surrendered, which was not the norm at the time, right? Like, if knights surrendered, you were supposed to take them prisoner. Then they burned 400 Cathars at the stake at Lavoir. Interestingly, at the same time, Toulouse was being terrorized by a vigilante group called the White Brotherhood. The White Brotherhood would carry out nightly attacks on Cathar and Jewish homes. Like, I have no proof of this, but damn if it doesn't make me think of the Ku Klux Klan, right? Like, it makes me wonder about, like, the Klan's historical predecessors. Makes you think. Raymond VI got excommunicated for a fifth time in 1211. Pope Innocent III was busy preparing for a fifth crusade in the Middle East. You know, related to this, he passed laws requiring Jews and Muslims to wear a yellow badge. Yes, this is a historical precedent to the Jewish badges of the Holocaust. Pope Innocent III also decided to allow one of the Crusaders, Simon de Montfort, to become the new Count of Toulouse, thereby disinheriting the sons of Raymond VI from most, but not all, of their family's holdings. Even separate from the Cathar issue, the Toulousians hated de Montfort, and they were super pissed at the decision that, you know, from the Pope that he would be the new Count. Nevertheless, the Crusaders sacked Toulouse for a month, After that, Simon de Montfort imposed heavy taxes on the town. Once he left, the Toulousians immediately started stockpiling weapons and planning a revolt. Not long after that, Raymond VI actually was able to capture Toulouse back, and the city was happy about it, which is interesting. Simon de Montfort's forces rushed back to Toulouse to try to recapture it, but they were stuck in a stalemate siege that lasted 9 months. Finally, on June 25th, 1218, Simon de Montfort's head was crushed by a stone launched from a catapult on the walls of Toulouse. Legend has it women were operating the catapult. That more or less brought an end to the Albigensian Crusade, though there would still be a siege at Montségur, which was the last Cathar castle. At Montségur, they held out like sort of like a Cathar Masada, and Montségur is notable for all of the modern-day legends surrounding it, which we will talk about. Now, the Cathars also had a strong presence in troubadours at the time, and they continued to have that influence on troubadours. And one epic poem, called The Song of the Cathar Wars, gave Simon de Montfort a fitting epitaph. And I quote, "The epitaph says, for those who can't read it, that he is a saint and martyr who shall breathe again and shall in wondrous joy inherit and flourish, shall wear a crown and be seated in the kingdom. And I have heard it said that this must be so, if by killing men and shedding blood, by damning souls and causing deaths, by trusting evil counsels, by setting fires, destroying men, seizing lands, and encouraging pride, by kindling evil and quenching good, by killing women and slaughtering children, a man can in this world win Jesus Christ. Certainly, Count Simon wears a crown and shines in heaven above." Unquote. Now, what had actually been accomplished by the Albigensian Crusade? Malcolm Barber, the medieval scholar, the modern medieval scholar, wrote, "The relationship between Montfort's unceasing military activity and the actual extirpation of the Cathars is much more complex than the Pope's rhetoric suggests. Out of the 37 places de Montfort is known to have besieged, contemporary chroniclers only record 3 where perfect, which is to say Cathars, were actually known to be located." Unquote. Further, there were some 63 or so towns that de Montfort seized which had no known Cathar presence. The Crusaders seem to have taken for granted that anyone defending themselves must have been a Cathar. But of course that is not at all likely or realistic to assume. Further, mass burnings of Cathars was something that only occurred mostly in the first half of the Crusade, and more or less stopped as they approached and surrounded Toulouse. It has been alleged that de Montfort was much more interested in acquiring treasure and land than in exterminating the Cathars. Crusaders, whether in the Holy Land or in the Languedoc, were allowed and encouraged to settle in the lands that they conquered. In this case, however, few of the Crusaders were able to establish long-term dynasties, as they were all either killed in subsequent uprisings or chose not to stay. Alternate motivations for the Albigensian Crusade are another thing we will revisit later. And the most important fact for the Albigensian Crusade not being about exterminating the Cathars is that the Cathars did not disappear. Instead, they went underground. They became secretive. Entirely related to this, the Catholic Church was not done with the Languedoc, and this is when they invented the Inquisition. Now, I know a lot of people think Inquisition, they think Spain, they think crypto-Jews and crypto-Muslim converts, but no, it was related to the Cathars first. So Pope Gregory the Ninth was now in charge, and he was pissed off. Because in 1231, they had discovered a group of Cathars active in Rome itself. In response, the Pope granted the Dominican friars the right to become inquisitors and gave them the power to arrest and judge heretics. One scholar called the Inquisition one of the most effective means of thought control that Europe has ever known. And it is very interesting, actually, to consider the Inquisition as mind control technology, or brainwashing, or certainly social control, right? So the first instance of the Inquisition was in the Rhineland in 1143. This guy was known as Conrad of Marburg. Monty pointed out this was a period of time when people did not have last names. They would just say, you know, their first name and the place they were from. So this is Conrad of Marburg. Conrad believed that he had uncovered a heresy that he called Luciferianism. This, of course, turned out to be more or less the same accusations that the church had used against the Orleans heretics in 1022, as in devil worship, sexual orgies, a new thing here, kissing goat assholes, so what would be all the classics of the witch hunts, right? Conrad of Marburg condemned at least hundreds and possibly thousands to be burned at the stake. Presumably, most of these were not actually Cathars, and the population absolutely hated Conrad. He eventually overstepped his bounds by accusing Count Henry II of heresy. Count Henry II demanded his right to a fair trial, including, you know, confronting witnesses and seeing what they actually said. And when these witnesses were produced, wouldn't you know, they were all Henry II's personal enemies. So he ended up with a fair trial and was found innocent, thereby calling into question the majority of these so-called Luciferian convictions. It's interesting, because Conrad of Marburg maybe thought he was going to do a new Albigensian Crusade 2.0. In fact, he called for that very thing. This time, though, nobody was having it, and no less than a Franciscan monk stabbed Conrad of Marburg to death, and that was the end of the Inquisition in the Rhineland. As these accusations were even more baseless than with Peter of Castelnau, this murder did not provoke a military invasion. Now, another Inquisition occurred in 1239 by a guy named Robert the Bulgarian. It's believed that by being Bulgarian, he could really sniff out the Cathars and Bogomils, right? He would burn 180 heretics at Mon Ami in Champagne. Now, these might have actually been Cathars, which is not obviously to say that it was justified, especially considering that Robert the Bulgarian would later be imprisoned for his excesses. But if we're talking Inquisition, what was the Inquisition's standard operating procedure as of this period of time? Mind you, this is not the Spanish Inquisition, which I think is a version that most people are familiar with, if at all. So, the first thing an inquisitor would do upon arriving in a town would be to talk to the clergy. Then, assuming they were Orthodox, he would give the town a sermon and demand a profession of faith from all males over the age of 14 and all females over the age of 12. The age difference, I guess, because women are more sinful, right? Those who refused would be questioned, and those who agreed would be encouraged and or forced to denounce their neighbors. Cathars who confessed were forced to resettle and wear yellow crosses on their clothes. After those early missteps, you know, the guys I mentioned a minute ago, there were, in fact, some basic requirements for convictions. Here are the requirements. Inquisitors needed at least two witnesses in order to convict someone. However, the accused did not have the right to face their accusers. This would still open the field wide up for just accusing your enemies, right? Now, let's get to the really mind-bending shit. You could and often did have to confess your dead relatives as heretics, and if your dead relatives were properly convicted, the inquisitors would dig up their bodies and burn them. Living relatives, even if Catholic, would still have to wear yellow crosses if their dead relatives were found guilty. Proof of heresy was pretty insane too, like for instance, anyone caught with a Bible would be potentially suspect. There is a well-documented instance of an old woman, an old Cathar, on her deathbed, asking for the consolamentum rite. She was under the impression that she was talking to the Cathar bishop, but she did not realize that she was asking for this from the Catholic bishop. The Catholic bishop ordered her taken out of her bed and burned. These inquisitors were frequently murdered, as you might expect, and there are various stories of inquisitors starting to dig up the graves of the town and for locals to just like beat the inquisitors to death over it. Now, Catharism did not disappear. In France, I believe, it tended to blend into the Waldensian movement over time. Interestingly, there were documented connections between Cathars and the Alumbrados of Spain, which we talked about briefly in my episode with Monty about the Illuminati. Later on, there was almost a revival of Catharism in the 14th century, but in a more decentralized, non-hierarchical form, almost like cells, if you will, which are virtually impossible to fight or, you know, stop. And I would argue that this is where Catharism sort of gets spooky. I really did not find much evidence of them actually being guilty of any real crimes in this, like, pre-Albigensian Crusade. Post-Albigensian Crusade, they get pretty freaking weird, actually. There is a well-documented case of a Catholic priest who was a Cathar secretly, named Peter Clerg, who would sleep with many different women in his village, including, like, having relations with them in the church. So, we're talking substantiated cases of some weird shit post-Albigensian Crusade. Either way, the historian R.I. Moore has argued that Western society formed its institutions partially through the persecution of heretics in the 13th century. Whether you look at warfare, key types of legislation in religious and civil authority, the Inquisition, just war theory, like, a lot of this dates back to these events. So much of what we have today is grounded in the persecution of the Cathars in the Albigensian Crusade and the ensuing Inquisition. Finally, to lighten up here, at least until the next episode, I gotta talk about the legend of the Cathar treasure. A lot of this overlaps with some Knights Templar stuff. So, there were legends that the Cathars buried treasure, like in response to the Albigensian Crusade. Most of that appears to come from French authors in the 19th century, but not all of it. The idea that there could have been Cathar buried treasure is certainly possible. But to take it to the next level, there was the idea, needless to say without like any proof at all, that the Cathars had the Holy Grail. Although this idea was repopularized in the 19th century, it did actually originate in the 13th century, which is to say while the Cathars were still around, because a lot of Grail myths also just came out of this troubadour legacy of southern France, like Crétin de Troyes. I don't know how to fucking say it. The troubadour who famously did all of the stories. Like, he had his famous Percival, the story of the Grail, like the most famous troubadour, basically. Now, as I mentioned before, many troubadours were Cathars, and there were many Knights Templar present before, during, and after the Albigensian Crusade. Knights Templar were major landowners in the Languedoc. Many Knights Templar refused to participate in the Albigensian Crusade. It has been speculated that the Knights Templar and the Cathars were sympathetic to each other. The Knights Templar would famously be accused of heresy not long after, and they would be suppressed in a similar way in the early 14th century. Now, for some people, the Holy Grail is meant literally. For other people, the Grail is simply a metaphor for spiritual development. For others, they view it alchemically, and or related to the Philosopher's Stone. And of course, there's the whole thing about the Holy Grail being the womb of Mary Magdalene, and or any potential offspring. The book Holy Blood, Holy Grail famously covers this theory. Then of course, it appears in the Da Vinci Code. It doesn't really groove with Cathar doctrines, which does not seem to believe that Jesus Christ was married, or was flesh and blood at all. Personally, I don't believe there is a whole lot to any of this Holy Grail stuff, except esoteric spiritual wankery, but that's just me. Separate from that, there's not a ton on the Cathar angle to a lot of this esoteric spiritual wankery, except that people allege that there are connections here. Now, it might be fun to go through some of the people who are modern-day Cathars, neo-Cathars, if you will. If you'll notice, much like with the Knights Templar, the historical group of people are one thing, and the people who attach themselves centuries later to this legacy are absolute freaks and weirdos. Like, not at all particularly related, it seems like, to the actual Cathar movement. If the Cathars were like some Middle Ages version of Quakers, neo-Cathars are freaking weird. Like, there are a lot of these guys. The Cathars, the historical Cathars, figure prominently in the European cultic milieu. I have half a dozen historians who can attest to a huge cleft between the historical Cathars and the Neo-Cathars. I have a long list of occultists who will at least reference the Cathars. But simply mentioning a long list of occultists who talk about the Cathars is probably less convincing to you than telling you the unfolding of the Cathar extended universe. And I mean that in a purely fictional sense. Like, the legend of the Cathars has unfolded, and it's pretty much as transparently fictional as the Star Wars extended universe. So the first guy, the main first guy in the Neo-Cathar stuff, was named Napoleon Bayrat. He essentially wrote fiction about the Cathars, but he sort of passed it off as historical fact. His book on the Cathars is not well regarded by historians because he basically made it up. He injected a lot of modern-day French anti-clerical sentiments into the story, which almost fits because the Cathars were anti-clerical in a certain sense, but not in the modern French sense. And Peyrot would mysticize the Cathars a ton, which is something you will see a lot from here on out. It's only a loose analogy, but you know how, like, maybe American hippies would, like, mysticize Native Americans? Well, European hippies would do this for the Cathars, right? So Peyrot's Cathar legend was taken up by a guy named Josephine Peladon, who was a French occultist who was also a novelist. He was also a Rosicrucian and a Martinist. Martinism being a French secret society, right? Peladon was friends with Baudelaire and Huysmans. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but you know, like, some of the interesting decadent symbolist French guys, right? Decadent symbolist art and neo-Catharism, man. They kind of went hand in hand. So the next most important guy, not the first, but maybe the most important, would be Déodat Rocher, who was an unabashed pro-Cathar writer. Rocher had a long, interesting life, which would probably be worth examining more closely. Rocher got interested in the Cathars because he was from the Languedoc. Rocher joined the Martinist order. He joined the Gnostic Church of France. He became a magistrate. That was his day job. Rocher got into psychic research. He also joined a French Masonic lodge. He also got into Rudolf Steiner and anthroposophy. He also chose to live in Béziers out of some sort of solidarity with and interest in the Cathars. So during World War II, Rocher was sidelined by the Vichy regime. He just sort of sat it out. And then after World War II, he devoted himself to Cathar studies. He founded the Cathar Remembrance and Study Society. Rocher took a decidedly syncretic approach to Cathar studies, which is a nice way of saying he made shit up. Rocher, in particular, studied cave markings, scratchings, engravings that were found near Montségur, including pentagrams. He claimed that these were made by Cathars. Rocher took nearly any cave graffito that wasn't basically done with spray paint as authentic Cathar engravings. His findings would be heavily questioned by other scholars. You know, side note here, this episode will certainly come out after the Farms series, you know, Recluse of the Farm. He did a series on competing notions of America's past, where we talk about essentially anomalous archaeological findings and how a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them are elaborate hoaxes. I was a guest on one episode in particular where we were talking about that. So go check that out. It's very interesting. The one that comes to mind is in the American Southwest, they found carvings that are supposed to be the Hebrew Ten Commandments, and they're supposed to be like thousands and thousands of years old. But Keith Allen Dennis was talking about how historians don't really think they're actually that old, and that possibly some Mormon settlers might have done it. Many such cases, right? And we will talk a little bit later about the idea of maybe pushing Cathars to be some sort of more Gnostic than they actually were. We'll get to that. But to give you a taste of what Roche was about, here is a quote of his about Catharism as such. Before Christ, who was as its dawning, Catharism had shone its light upon the Brahmins of India, the Magi of Persia, the Essenes of Judea, and Greece upon Pythagoras and Plato. Unquote. Which does not make sense, conflating all of those groups who held different beliefs. So we're talking about Roche, who fundamentally believes that, like, Catharism has historical, strong historical spiritual ties to all of those groups. Like, if you want to assert that, that's fine, okay, whatever, but, like, it's not serious research. So Roche, however, headed serious research groups. The Cathar Research Society, right? He also held a loose, informal group of collaborators in the 1930s. I use collaborator mostly ironically, right? This group included Maurice Magre, who wrote historical fiction about the Cathars, which was very popular. Magre's novels were loosely anti-Semitic, and of course not particularly historically accurate. Then there was Simone Weil, who was quite Cathar curious. Weil wrote about the medieval Languedoc as a moral utopia, which is laughable, right? Most notably, there was also Otto Rahn. Side note, as so often happens, I wrote these episodes before Subliminal Jihad, did an episode or two on Otto Rahn. I haven't listened to them yet, but I'm sure they're great. I'm sure that we don't disagree with each other. But either way, you know, I'm not planning on doing Otto Rahn in depth. So, Otto Rahn, for those of you who don't know about him already, he was a German student studying in Paris. Rahn wrote a book called Crusade Against the Grail, which was a collection of the French Grail stories that compared them to the Parsifal myth, to the Parsifal legend. In Rahn's book, the guardian of the Grail was guarding a sacred stone said to have been dropped when the angels originally fell from heaven, and that was the true Grail. Rahn also cast the Cathars as much more pagan than Christian. In 1937, Rahn would publish a book called The Court of Lucifer, A Heretic's Journey in Search of the Lightbringers, which was another book about Cathars and the Holy Grail. Rahn would eventually move back to Germany and join the SS. Rahn wrote the Cathars as saying, "We do not need the God of Rome, we have our own. We do not need the commandments of Moses, we carry in our hearts the legacy of our ancestors. It is Moses who is imperfect and impure. We Westerners of Nordic blood, we call ourselves Cathars, just as Easterners of Nordic blood are called Parsis, the pure. Our heaven is open only to those who are not creatures of an inferior race, or bastards, or slaves. It is open to Aryas. Their name means they are nobles and lords." Unquote. That's right, Rahn had basically turned the Cathars into proto-Nazis. Ron compared the struggles of the Cathars with the struggles of the Nazi Party. Which, maybe that would make sense before the Nazis took power. No, it doesn't make sense, but it could be more, could make slightly more sense. But, as always, it completely reverses who is slaughtering who and who is being slaughtered. In no sense were the Nazis persecuted, right? So this book caught the attention of Heinrich Himmler. Himmler set up Ron as an occult researcher. Ron was investigating the whole Holy Grail thing for Himmler, which is insane to think about. Supposedly, the Nazis at least showed up and poked around Montsegur trying to find this stupid Holy Grail, just in case it was real. The rumors, however, would get blown way out of proportion, like most Nazi treasure hunting. You know, Indiana Jones is simply the Hollywood version of a whole cottage industry of, like, weirdly, perversely taking interest in Nazi treasure hunting. Eventually, Ron, who was a homosexual, fell out of favor and was maybe suicided by the Nazis. The Vichy regime eventually got way into the Cathar shit, like during World War II and afterwards, in a lot of the same ways that esoteric Nazis would get into all kinds of weird shit. The Vichy types believed that top Nazi leadership was part of a secret neo-Cathar pagan secret society. Not all Vichy types, I'm saying the ones into the Cathar stuff. In some tellings, the Holy Grail was not a stone like Ron said, but, get this, a non-Jewish table of 10 commandments. Or I guess maybe not 10, but like, a table of commandments, not perverted by the perfidious Hebrews, supposedly. All of this was taken so seriously, which is to say, you know, somewhat seriously, that in 1978, a group of German Boy Scouts were arrested in Montsegur, and they were accused of trying to steal Cathar artifacts. And obviously, therefore, they were Nazis. This provoked a minor diplomatic incident. On the flip side, and to be fair, during and after World War II, the French Resistance also used the Cathar legend, much more suited to their needs, as they were, of course, invaded by a murderous, psychopathic invading force. Just like how everybody wants to be an Indian, I guess in France everybody wanted to be a Cathar. So the ongoing popularity of the Cathar legend led to multiple archaeological digs at Montsegur and elsewhere, looking for tunnels, yeah, we're talking tunnels, and hidden rooms. They never found anything. Nevertheless, that didn't stop a guy named Ferdinand Neil, who published a theory that Montsegur was supposed to be, mind you, that's a castle, right, was supposed to be a solar temple. Again, largely without evidence. This fed into the nascent French hippie movement, the Baba Cool. For those of you who don't know, of course the French had hippies, they were known as the Baba Cool, who loved to visit French castles and tell each other that these castles were actually solar temples and or earth cults destroyed by Catholicism. And of course, there were a lot of things about the Cathars that seemed to match the hippie lifestyle. Of course, there was vegetarianism, rejecting marriage, a proto-feminism, the troubadour legacy. Yeah, man, that's groovy. Now, the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail came along, then the Da Vinci Code, both of which rely partially on the Cathar legend. The legend, I say, not the facts, right? The area around René-le-Château is apparently full of treasure diggers searching for Cathar treasure. Also, apparently UFO sightings are pretty prevalent in that region. Interesting, right, how like weird esoteric beliefs, treasure hunting, UFO stuff, all goes hand in hand. Now another guy, separate from the Rocher Circle, was named Arthur Girdham. He was an English physician and psychiatrist who attended Oxford. He got into some of the whole, like, anti-psychiatry movement. He also got into Freud and Jung. He was way into the Cathars. He was also into ESP, reincarnation, and the paranormal in general. Even creepier, Gerdham documented a whole series of synchronicities that he believed were drawing him to the Cathars. And, like, I'm being generous here, saying synchronicities. He was looking for this shit. He was getting into past life regression shit. He believed that he was a Cathar, I'm pretty sure. Interestingly, Gerdham was a close personal friend to Colin Wilson, the occult author. Even weirder, the Order of the Solar Temple. You remember those guys? The mass suicide group? In Montreal and elsewhere. They based a lot of their lore on Cathar Castle legends. You remember all the shit about Montsegur being a solar temple? They were extremely into that. Even weirder, after the FBI assault on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, the feds found 9 people dead in a wheel-like formation, with their heads in and their feet out, which was a old Cathar burial method. Finally, to get really nutty with it, you know who else was way into the Cathars? An enterprising U.S. Army Signals Corps veteran named Marshall Applewhite, who ran a plucky group called Heaven's Gate. Heaven's Gate cult writings would frequently reference Cathar legends. Ooh, spooky, right? Yeah. To finish the episode, I will quote from Sean Martin's book discussing another quasi-Cathar named Philip K. Dick. The great American science fiction author Philip K. Dick summed up the need for and the difficulties of practicing the Cathar's kind of spirituality in his novel Velus. The hero, tormented by the trivialities of the modern world, becomes a convert to Gnosticism, as was Dick himself. He is mocked by his friends for his attempt to live as a first-century Christian, but points out that the persecuting society, the Roman Empire in the novel, quote, never ended, unquote. He feels that life as a Gnostic is the only solution, and near the end of the novel concludes, since the universe is actually composed of information, then it can be said that information will save us. This is the saving gnosis which the Gnostics sought. There is no other road to salvation. Thus it is said that we are saved by the grace of God and not by good works, that all salvation belongs to Christ, who I say is a physician. The physician has come to us a number of times under a number of names, but we are not yet healed. Unquote. I suppose, among all the many reasons why I am not technically a Gnostic, I do not think that information is going to save us, despite my pursuit of it. And I will say, for the listener's sake, this is just part one. There are, in fact, a few more Neo-Cathars that come up in modern history. I will discuss them in future episodes, but I guarantee you will not be able to predict who I am going to talk about. So you see, I did not do a Cathar episode simply because it's interesting on its own terms, which it is. I did it because occultists and weirdos are fixated on them, and because it sets us up to talk about a few things that I've always wanted to talk about. Do I think that the historical Cathars were Satanists? No. Do I think that the Neo-Cathars are Satanists? Like Tracy Twyman? Yes, absolutely. No, I will not elaborate. For sources today, I used the books The Cathars, the Most Successful Heresy of the Middle Ages by Sean Martin. I used the book The Cathars, The Perfect Heresy by Stephen O'Shea. I use the book The Friar of Carcassonne, Revolt Against the Inquisition in the Last Days of the Cathars by Stephen O'Shea, and a redacted source, soon to be revealed. Giving it away now would give the game away. And various articles as well. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. I appreciate you. I am not funded, backed by any other groups. This is all independent, baby. It's just you and me. And remember, for me, it's not parasocial. I appreciate you, dear listener. So please tell a friend about the show. It's all word of mouth. Nobody's really boosting me, so it's up to you, dear listener. Just show it to a friend. Say, hey, I'm getting real weird, and it's this show's fault. Check it out. Now I need to be on my way to Toulouse, France. See you next week, and God bless.